Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now we continue our 30 Issues election series, Issue 28, So Many Ways to Disenfranchise Voters. Let's listen to some history. After slavery, African-American men were technically given the right to vote. No woman could vote at that time. That took until the election of 1920. But voting rights on paper started a long history that is still taking place of finding secondary ways of denying black people the right to vote. The most famous march for voting rights in the civil rights era was the Selma to Montgomery March in Alabama in March of 1965, led by Martin Luther King, who had won the Nobel Peace Prize the year before, and his clout was at its peak. He was asked in an interview during that march what forms this clever discrimination, this secondary discrimination, takes.
It takes several forms. First, it takes the form of complex literacy tests. Questions are asked on these tests that are so complex and absurd that even the Chief Justice of our Supreme Court would find difficult in answering them.
Literacy tests crafted with the knowledge that black people proportionately had less education than whites. The Voting Rights Act passed, signed by President Johnson in 1965. If people hoped that would be the end of the story, well, it wasn't. The literacy tests that Dr. King described were gone, but many new ways of suppressing black votes would become common. Let's flash forward to the infamous election of 2000 in the state of Florida. You can blame Ralph Nader, or you can blame the faulty butterfly ballots in Palm Beach County for George Bush's tiny margin of victory. But another factor that got some press, but much less press at the time, was a state-run purge of convicted felons from the voter rolls. Convicted felons cannot vote in Florida, even if they've served their time. That's different from New York. But the way the purge was designed, it apparently bumped thousands of people off the rolls who were not convicted felons, but just had similar names. Here is a one-minute excerpt from the documentary American Blackout, in which former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney narrates a section about this and includes a question that she asked James Lee, vice president of a company called ChoicePoint, at a town hall meeting. ChoicePoint was the company that aggregated voter information, like the felons list, for the state of Florida that year. Cynthia McKinney speaks first.
What ChoicePoint admitted to us at the town hall meeting was that they weren't looking for exact matches.
Florida officials only wanted an 80% match on the last name. Now, the result of that was to capture the names of people with similar names.
If John Smythe was the convicted felon and John Smith was on the voter roll, well, John Smith became a convicted felon.
DBT told state officials that the rules for creating this list would mean a significant number of people who were not convicted felons would be included on the list.
And the state of Florida said, well, give it to us anyway, because we want that comprehensive, inaccurate list.
So who exactly told you to provide a list that wasn't verified?
The state of Florida through their Division of Elections.
The state of Florida requested that kind of list. Former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney and James Lee from ChoicePoint. Inexact matches of felons' names, an 80% match, James Lee testified there, was close enough for the state, another way to disenfranchise voters. This came despite the fact that Congress had continued to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act. In 2006, the act was reauthorized again with a unanimous vote in the United States Senate and nearly that in the House, and the signature of President George W. Bush, a Republican. The law continued to require, as in the past, that states with a history of voting rights violations get pre-clearance from the U.S. Justice Department for any changes to their voting laws. That was the heart of the law. But Shelby, Alabama, took the nearly unanimous Congress and executive branch to the Supreme Court, and remarkably, in 2013, they won. undoing the preclearance requirement considered to be the heart of the Voting Rights Act. This over the objection of Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who cited another way that states were trying to disenfranchise people based on race.
Discrimination is discrimination. And what Congress said is it continues, not in terms of voter numbers, but in terms of examples of other ways to disenfranchise voters, like moving a voting booth from a convenient location for all voters to a place that historically has been known for discrimination. I think that's an example taken from one of the Section 2 and 5 cases from Alabama.
With so many examples of different ways to disenfranchise voters, how did the Supreme Court majority conclude the Voting Rights Act preclearance provision was no longer necessary? Here's what Justice Antonin Scalia attributed it to: too much entitlement under the law for African Americans.
I think it is very likely attributable to a phenomenon that is called perpetuation of racial entitlement. It's been written about. Whenever a society adopts racial entitlements, it is very difficult to get out of them through the normal political processes. I don't think there is anything to be gained by any senator to vote against continuation of this act. And I am fairly confident it will be reenacted in perpetuity unless a court can say it does not comport with the Constitution. You have to show, when you're treating different states differently, that there's a good reason for it.
Justice Scalia, and before that we heard Justice Sotomayor with obviously a very different point of view from the oral arguments in that case. The result of the 5-4 ruling in 2013 is playing out in a presidential election for the first time this year. North Carolina, Texas, and a number of other states are back in federal court fighting over a list of rules they now have enacted that might in many cases have been prevented in advance under the Voting Rights Act preclearance provision, and that represent more ways to disenfranchise voters indirectly: rollbacks of early voting, limits on absentee voting, voter ID laws tilted toward groups more likely to have certain forms of ID, and more. Another example: New Hampshire Republicans tried to stop college students in the state from voting in that swing state if their parents lived elsewhere. That failed in the New Hampshire legislature, though. There are so many ways to disenfranchise voters. Now, when President Johnson advocated the Voting Rights Act in 65, just after the Selma to Montgomery march, he warned against people not affected, thinking they didn't have a stake.
Their cause must be our cause, too. Because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome.
President Johnson in 1965, and that's our brief audio history in our 30 Issues election series, Issue 28, So Many Ways to Disenfranchise Voters. With us briefly now to talk about it is Alex Kasar, professor of history and social policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, author of books including The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States. He also has an upcoming book called Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College? Professor Kasar, thanks very much for doing this. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure to be back on the show.
And it's interesting to go back to the civil rights Jim Crow era and hear that Dr. King clip about the means of stopping black people from voting being indirect even then. Was that cleverness the heart of the discrimination tactics in the South?
It was a cleverness, a resilience, a determination to not allow African Americans to wield any real political power. And once the federal government had gotten involved, pressuring them, they were, in most places, pretty resilient and really imaginative about things that might be done in order to keep power just where it was.
I read eye-popping statistics about how effective it was, like very small percentages of the black adult population being registered to vote compared to whites in many places. Do you know any of that?
Yes. Well, I mean, if you look particularly at the Deep South, Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, the figures before the Voting Rights Act were on the order of about 5% of African Americans. It had gone up somewhat during the 1950s, but it was a tiny percent. It was really a tiny percentage. I do want to add, though, Brian, and this follows on the thought that you had uttered about in the Johnson quote about we should recognize that this matters to all of us, that that New York State, and this isn't just a Southern issue, New York State had an English language literacy requirement to vote until the 1960s.
You anticipated my next question, which is, what about the North? In fact, in addition to mostly Southern states, New York City was one of those areas that had a preclearance requirement for any voting law changes under that struck down section of the Voting Rights Act.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. What New York City had done, and parts of New York and some other northern states, was targeted at its own minorities. Much earlier in the 20th century, in one of the clever devices deployed in New York was to make the only days of voter registration to put them right squarely on the Jewish holidays of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur.
Because Jews tended to vote for Democrats?
Because Jews tended to vote for socialists.
Uh-huh. Were you familiar with the Florida felons issue from 2000?
Yes, yes, I was, and I thought your summary got it exactly right. It was extraordinary how imperfect and how imperfect the matching lists were. And how everybody knew that. I mean, everybody who was doing the purging of the voting rolls. And they didn't seem to care.
Any idea how many votes that might have cost Al Gore of people who were wrongly bumped from the rolls? Is there a good number?
There's not a good number. There's a because it's a two-part number. One is how many people were bumped, and the second is of the people who were bumped, how many would have voted. And we don't know. It's certainly reasonable to believe that the number was well above the margin of victory in the state election.
Has that been reformed? If you don't know,
Florida made another effort. I mean, there were howls about it. Florida said it was not going to do that again. It would not use such inadequate data to purge people. And then it made another effort 4 years later to do something similar. But people are alert to it now and stood up and stopped it. I don't know exactly what they are doing right now on this issue because the numbers in Florida, the latest estimates I've seen is that there are 1 million people in Florida who are disenfranchised because of the felon voting provisions.
How surprised were you when the Supreme Court threw out the heart of the Voting Rights Act in 2013?
I was not surprised because those of us who spend too much time watching these things thought we could see it coming. There had been a decision a few years earlier where Justice Roberts had signaled his disinterest in continuing the Voting Rights Act and his particular perspective that, I mean, the basic argument was that because things have improved for African Americans, which is, in the political front at least, undeniable, but because things had improved, there was no need to keep the Voting Rights Act and the preclearance provision, which have played a major role in producing that improvement. So I was not surprised, although I found the argument kind of a little more contorted than I had imagined.
How much has that 2013 ruling affected state voting laws or attempts to make them more restrictive for this year's presidential election? Because as I noted, this is the first presidential election since that 2013 ruling.
Oh, it had an enormous effect in, you know, what are called the covered areas, the 9 states and parts of 6 others that were covered by the preclearance provision. As you mentioned, several states, well, Texas had passed a voter ID and other law that had been turned back by the federal government under the Voting Rights Act. And after the Shelby decision, within hours, and that's a literal description, not a metaphoric description, within hours of the court decision, Texas implemented this law. Then North Carolina went even further, and a number of other southern states did the same thing. That said, some lower federal courts, both district and appeals courts, in the course of the late spring and the summer, seem to have put a check, at least temporarily, on the most draconian of these laws.
Go ahead.
They turned back the Texas law, sent it back, and you know, not every provision. It's a complicated ruling, but they basically told Texas to do something at least moderately more friendly to less privileged people. And in North Carolina, they just sent the whole thing back and said you're discriminating.
If Justice Scalia is replaced with a more liberal judge, do you think the Voting Rights Act will be restored to what it was, or should that even be the goal?
I think it's unlikely that the Voting Rights Act will be restored to what it was by the courts. I think there would be the Supreme Court would be reluctant to take that kind of steps so quickly. I think the real goal, you know, which cannot be achieved just by the court, I think the real goal would be to have Congress act and to produce a more comprehensive and, frankly, more up-to-date piece of legislation. I mean, some of the criticism that the Voting Rights Act was out of date was accurate. It was still needed, and it would be far better to have had the preclearance provision than to have nothing, which is what we have now. But if we can devise, as people in Congress have already devised several versions of legislation
pass muster at the Supreme Court to kind of accomplish the same goal.
Right, exactly. Yeah, sorry, my mind wandered there for a minute. But the other thing I was going to say about the court, about the role of the court, is that if Justice Scalia is replaced with a more liberal justice, then I think that the voter ID issue will return to the court for the first time in 10 years, this time with much more data. And I would think it likely that the Supreme Court will prevent the implementation of any strict voter ID laws.
Alex Kaysar, professor of history and social policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, author of the book The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States, and an upcoming book called Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College? Why don't you come back when that comes out, and we'll ask that very relevant question.
I would very much like to.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
And that's our 30 Issues Election Series, Issue 28 for today. So many ways to disenfranchise voters. We continue with Issue 28 week on tomorrow's show. Of course, a lot more to come this morning. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.